Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
All right, guys, let's move into our third section now, and that is, I think it's going to be the one that might take us the longest to get through, but it's also so needed. This word gender comes up so often in this, and in the Proclamation on the Family, which is certainly a major document that in some ways we have to wrestle with if we're going to move ahead on these questions. Gender is just this amazingly complex category, and yet it seems to be all whittled down into sort of one within a lot of Mormon discourse. So Christine, as a feminist, I know you're really well versed in, you know, sort of the separation from gender and sex, you know, differences in sex body versus categories and cultural sort of expectations and roles. So jump in with any of that good stuff there. And Taylor, if you don't mind taking us through the three ways that you see gender talked about, the wider discussion, how it's conflated in Mormonism into one, and if we can really start separating this and having a better discussion with this, we might really be able to clear some important ground here.
Sure. Well, this section was one of the hardest to write, one of the hardest to think through, and part of it is that the category of gender is so fraught in feminist discourse, and it's really been a category that's been under serious scrutiny for the last, you know, 50, 60 years. So it's hard to sort of write about, especially in a really short section. And there just, I would say that there needs to be a lot more thinking for Latter-day Saints about theologies of gender on really all sides of the spectrum so that we can keep talking about this. There's been a lot of course, great feminist Latter-day Saint work done in the last few decades, and I think those conversations need to continue. But one of the problems that I had in writing this section is that there seemed to be a relatively easy argument that could be made, which is that feminist theory at a certain point sort of separated out three different categories for thinking about human experience. Well, not all human experience, but thinking about some of the areas of inquiry that they were looking at. One was sex, which we think of as maybe our biological, morphological bodies. Gender, which was then understood to refer to the sort of culturally constructed ways that we think about masculinity and femininity. And then a third category eventually emerged, which was sexuality, namely what we think of popularly as, you know, sexual orientation, sexual preferences, these things. And so it felt like there was a pretty easy argument to be made that gender is distinct from sexuality, that one's position as a masculine or feminine subject was not really in any way related to their sexual lives. And that's a pretty easy argument to make, and I was very tempted to make that, but I chose the more complicated route, which is to suggest that gender is not inseparable from the categories of sex and the categories of sexuality, and attempted to look at the ways in which Latter-day Saint uses of the term gender have really conflated these three different categories, and therefore I don't think that we can sort of simply say that sexuality is distinct from gender in an easy way. So I looked into the ways that I see that Latter-day Saints are defining the term. It's often left undefined. It sort of is just laid out there as, well, there's gender, there's eternal gender, there's eternal gender and identity and purpose, and no real content to that sometimes. But so I attempted to look at a number of different sources that would give a little bit more definition and see that sometimes they're defining it as what I said earlier in terms of sex, that gender just simply refers to the division of male and female bodies. Sometimes it refers to roles in terms of, especially around the division of labor and household economies. And then thirdly, it refers to things which is called identity, which is what we often think about our sexual identities in terms of, you know, homosexual or heterosexual or bisexual or transsexual, all these different ways that we can think about gendered identity. And suggest that a lot of the ways that we're using the term gender to talk about homosexuality are very much bound up in ideologies of hierarchies between males and females. And say that, you know, the ways that we think about homosexuality are deeply tied to feminist concerns about whether or not women can be equal partners in relationships or can be, you know, equal members of society and so on. So gender confusion, for instance, is talked about as one of the implications of homosexual relationships. And again, the idea that somebody is not acting in their gender in proper ways, that they're confused in certain ways as being a real serious concern. And the idea that men need to act as men or women need to act as women, of course, is based on these kinds of ideologies about sexual hierarchies. So anyway, that's what that section explores for the most part. That's the basic outline of it.
Yeah. Christine, do you want to jump in with anything that you saw in that section?
Sure. I think on the one hand, that speaking of gender as, you know, as all of these things, using a term that does, you know, conflate biological sex and sexuality and sort of cultural role assignments and performances can be really helpful, because we do in fact experience these things more holistically than, you know, than we're able to talk about them if we adopt the methodology and vocabulary of, you know, women's studies or gender studies. Because I don't experience dressing as a woman as completely separate from being attracted to men or wanting to attract men. You know, I mean, those things go together in the way that we experience our own lives. On the other hand, conflating them is dangerous, because you get sort of this idea that somehow being a female creature with female morphology means that you should enjoy a certain set of things to do, that somehow magically you should like changing diapers better than men like it, or that you should not mind being, you know, always in a subordinate role at church or whatever, because you are, you know, divinely created, as we can plainly see by the fact that you have breasts. It both gives us the possibility of acknowledging the totality of our experience, and it creates the danger of totalizing personhood in a way that is not helpful, that denies people the individual expression of their experience, sex and gender and sexuality. So it's just a mixed bag,
right.
I think. And I like the way that Taylor has sort of teased it out and at least forced us to look at all the categories that we're conflating.
Terrific. Yeah, I agree. It's very helpful, but like you say, it is... you know, you can get a little bit too, you can separate them too much. Yeah.
Just to add to that, maybe another way of thinking about it, there's a sort of a presumption that these things all cohere in certain ways, that one's body, one's desires, and one's roles should all cohere in some, you know, uniform way. But of course, the real lives of our experiences don't necessarily conform in those ways. And those norms are not necessarily descriptive. They're intending to, you know, have men and women perform in particular ways as well, in accordance with the expectations of their sex or their gender or their sexuality. So we also want to be just paying attention to the ways in which these ideals, these norms, often fail to describe people's whole totalities as well.
Right, and that takes us right into the two pieces that your initial jump into this section didn't hit. And that was, you know, you kind of talked about there's the body, this dimorphism, sexual dimorphism, male, female. Then there was the identity section. Then there was the roles, the gender roles and expectations of how you'll function in society. What about the mismatch between somebody's spirit or their identity, mm-hmm. their identity and their body is one thing. And then we have the very clear problematizing section of, if we're going to say gender is eternal, we have lots of bodies, I mean, more than people know, who are truly intersex, mm-hmm. that have no clear, you know, male or female.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
take us into both of those sections. I know you at least touched on them.
Well, just again to point, there are a number of different ways in which those various notions about what it means to be a male or what it means to be a female fail to correspond to reality. You mentioned some of them, but of course the experience that I think that we need to take very seriously of transsexual persons as not feeling at home in the particular body. And there are various ways of kind of critiquing some of that language as well, and the way that that language has been psychologized and pathologized, I think we need to be critical of as well. But that people's psychic experiences of their sex doesn't always correspond to their bodies. Of course, people's sexual desires don't always correspond to their expected sexual desires, as we've talked about in the case of gays and lesbians. But there are, of course, a number of people whose bodies don't correspond to either male or female, as you mentioned as well. And what does that mean? What do these things mean theologically? You know, they've been sort of dismissed as aberrations, or I think the language that some church leaders have used is as accidents of nature. And I think that it's often to those things which don't conform to our expectations that we need to pay the most attention to. You know, if maybe our categories aren't working precisely, and we can't just ignore the contrary evidence, right? We need to pay special attention to the evidence which points against some of our conclusions about the divisions, there being a binary division between male and female. So, yeah, there are a number of kind of theological problems that are raised by the real experiences of people who don't fit into this, image of the world that we've created.
Yeah, cool. Christine, can you do a little education for us about second wave feminism and the beginning of these being separated out, and you know where we stand in Mormonism today in terms of those, and then we can maybe get a little bit more into the Proclamation on the Family and its conflation after that. Do you mind?
No, I don't mind. What we think of as second wave feminism began in some ways with the book The Feminine Mystique, which was about trying to understand why women felt uneasy somehow in their prescribed lives as wives and homemakers and full-time parents, full-time mothers, caregivers for children and houses. And so people started to talk about the fact that just having female biology didn't necessarily make them enjoy spending time with small children more, or didn't necessarily make them any better at scrubbing floors, and that some of those things that were frequently called feminine were arbitrary and did reflect this hierarchy of the male and female and the sense that the female was well suited for jobs that many people find distasteful or tedious. And of course Mormons in some ways have responded to that discussion by acknowledging, in fact, that women are good at lots of things, that women have diverse interests, that women, President Hinckley, for instance, saying that women should get all of the education they can, and we have the example of him praising a woman who was a nurse for him at one time when he was ill, who had, gotten a good education and established a solid career in which her skills were sought after, so that after she had children, she could still have this outlet for her ambition and talent while paying attention to her children. So, in some ways, Mormon discourse has shifted along with post-second wave feminist American views on gender roles and on the kinds of opportunities that ought to be open to women and men equally. And then in other ways, we have really resisted that shift in discourse. And so we have, for instance, the Proclamation on the Family that says women are primarily responsible for the nurture of their children. And that's pretty vague, but of course the most common reading is that means women should, if at all possible, stay home with their children and take care of them full time. And that's, that's certainly a plausible reading, and I don't think anyone objects to it. Even while at the same time, it's immediately followed by this idea that women and men should help each other as equal partners. So we're deeply conflicted about how to respond to this second wave feminist idea that, you know, biology isn't destiny, and that women do have, you know, varied interests and talents that don't necessarily correspond to the roles that we would like to prescribe for them, either in the home or in the church. And, you know, so I think we're at an awkward place in our discourse. I think have embraced the idea that men and women are of equal value and equal worth, both in God's eyes and in terms of their skills and possibilities for contributing to society. And yet at the same time, we're really attached to this notion that there should be something distinctive about being female that suits one to nurture children or to be, you know, sweet and spiritual somehow and not susceptible to the notions, to certain temptations. You know, we categorize sexual sin as somehow masculine and more tempting, you know, to men than to women. And we speak as though the only sins women were capable of are, you know, low self-esteem and maybe gossip. And we, you know, so we want there to be something about being a woman that tells us how people should behave. And particularly within the family, we want there to be something unique about each sex, and we want that to mean something for their roles in the family. But I think we're less sure of what it is we want that to be than we used to be, except that we're pretty sure it has to do with who takes care of children, and that's sort of the last thing we've got left. And of course it. We clearly want it to have to do with who has sex with whom, right? I mean, that's the other sort of overriding concern that we have with gender. So, you know, so I'd say that those are sort of the last two things we have left where we really conflate morphology and prescribed social roles, which is men should have sex with women and women should take care of children. And that's really, in some ways, pretty... You know, it's a lot less content in the categories of masculine and feminine than we probably had, say, in 1960. But it's still enough to cause us a lot of trouble.
Well, I, Christine, I think you're absolutely right with respect to, you know, heterosexual folks, that those are the main issues that are sort of there. But for a lot of people, a lot of men and women whose behavior appears too masculine or too feminine, whichever one is the wrong one to have, then there are a lot of other ways that masculinity and femininity is sort of enforced in Mormonism, in dress, in hairstyle. There are all kinds of ways in which it still exists for non-heterosexual people. But I think you're right that for heterosexual people, there's been a real narrowing of what the major issues are for what counts as masculine and feminine. Yeah.
Yeah. Although I guess, I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's still really problematic for a woman to wear pants to church, but not the rest of the week, right? I mean, it's okay the rest of the time. So, you know, to just take that as a sort of metaphor for what our difficulties are.
Yeah, right. So, okay, Proclamation on the Family, then clearly, though, by it uses gender all the time. Is it, I don't, just maybe they don't like the word sex, you know, for whatever reason.
Yeah, no,
the
clearly S word, does do
the
that
S word. But, you know, right off the bat, you have all human beings, male and female, are created in the image of God. Each is a beloved spirit, son or daughter, heavenly parents, etc. Clearly, they're just talking about spirits having either being male or female. So that's it, even though they're using gender. Gender is an essential characteristic of individual, premortal, mortal, internal identity and purpose. So right up until where they say purpose, then, you know, you're clearly talking that they're talking about simply that. But then, as you said, Christine, go ahead, please.
Well, I was just going to say, I don't think they are just talking about that. I mean, I think in this insistence on maleness and femaleness, there's already anti-gay force intended behind those words. I mean, it's important to note that this document arose in the context of the church's attempts to be involved in the lawsuit about same-sex marriage in Hawaii, and it was in fact introduced as an exhibit in the church's brief trying to be named as a co-defendant with the state of Hawaii
right.
In that suit. So I think you have to read language about distinctive maleness and femaleness as also being about distinctive attraction to men and attraction to women, as being, you know, supposedly inseparably bound up with male or female biology.
Yeah, I agree with that. Taylor, go ahead and jump in.
Christine's absolutely right that the way that this text has often been read, I think, by many Latter-day Saint feminists and sort of critiqued and thought through, has often not paid attention to the context, the historical context of the document, very much tied up with the church's efforts against same-sex marriage. And the connection between between those two issues, that the text is both dealing with issues about sexuality as well as issues about women's roles, is something that it's important not to forget.
Right, right. I'm glad for all those clarifications. I guess where I was trying to say in that second paragraph of the proclamation is that normally, at least what it seemed to me they were talking about is sexual, you know, bodies. It was about bodies. Mm-hmm. You're right. It was tied up into this. And I'm, you know, the fact that the context was what it was, part of that amicus brief for Hawaii and as a political document, stuff, I'm grateful that it has never been established as a revelation. And when Elder Packer last year tried to call it a revelation, it was changed. So clearly, I think the church is going to be comfortably never making this official Declaration 3 or something, right? Do you guys have a sense that we're probably past the possibility of that happening?
Probably. I'd like to be more certain than I am.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'm hopeful that it is, and you know, right now its main function to me is like, yeah, this is an identifier. You're in a Latter-day Saint home, that the Proclamation of the Family is somehow framed and on a wall somewhere in a public area. You know, the Proclamation of the Family, it's problematic, but at least it's not canonical. And I think we can then talk about it a little bit. So, Taylor, you wanted to jump in.
I was just going to say that I think a common way of kind of limiting the authority of the Proclamation on the Family is to mention that it's not canonical, that it has sort of this deuterocanonical status. But I think ultimately it really needs to be engaged head on. It's taken as de facto doctrine. It was introduced in my ward today in the context of a ward conferences, when God spoke to us in the proclamation. I mean, I think that the way that it is understood in Latter-day Saint practice is indistinguishable at this point, really, doctrine.
I don't think
we can get around it as by saying it's not authoritative doctrine. I think we need to think of it as doctrine at this point.
Okay, well, and
as much as anything is doctrine.
Right. But then that really does make this very, very problematic for homosexual relationships.
Potentially. I mean, there are ways where we can read it in more expansive terms, and you know, but if the church does decide to change its practice and change its doctrine on this issue, you know, it's going to have to deal with this document. I don't think that it can sort of say, well, it was never doctrine. I think that it needs to really deal head on with some of the assumptions and articulations about human identity in that text.
Yeah, I guess in my ways, I'm being a little Pollyanna-ish as far as the ability to find some breathing room in a discussion by saying, you know, look, at this has been, there has been plenty of chances for this to be made a revelation. They haven't chosen to it. We recognize that the context of this was historical. I guess I'm just looking for places, you know, entry points to at least diffuse it to where we can take this, you know, not take it on, but at least look directly at it to try to get to these more expansive readings, either of it or simply this confusion of these three types of things: bodies, identity, and gender roles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So does that make any sense? That's where I was trying to do. And you guys you're at least saying you don't think anywhere close in the regular discussion that's happening on Sundays this is happening. But do you see it still as if you guys were to decide to dive in on a Sunday, do you dive in these areas, or how do you dive in to get a little discussion going? Do you just ignore the proclamation and go after it some other way?
You mean in church, like in a discussion at church.
Right. Would you just leave Proclamation on the Family out of it, or would you just say, let's, you know, I know that a lot of you are, you know, a lot of this thinking that we're hearing today is coming out of the idea that the Proclamation on the Family is a revelation. This is what God told us through the Proclamation, like Taylor said it happened today. Would you acknowledge it that way, or would you just try some other entry point than dealing with the Proclamation on the Family if you wanted to at least throw in a discussion starter on Sunday?
Well, I mean, I think the good news is that it's written in sort of vague and politically calculated ways that you can't, you know, I mean, it follows the statement about mothers nurturing children with two caveats, right, that men and women should help each other as equal partners and that individual circumstances necessitate adaptation. And so, you know, I tend to just, you know, take those as elastic clauses wide enough to drive a truck through and just, you know, come in with the truck.
Okay. And good. And I see
but
that.
I think it's a non-starter to try and say this isn't scripture or this is revelation. That discussion would go nowhere, I think.
That's good. Okay. So I've never tried it. I've never tried to take it on. Somehow or other, yeah. I think my high priest group is used to me enough that I probably could get away with it, but I probably wouldn't want to recommend that. You're right, for everybody. But Christine, what you just said, large enough to drive a truck through it, that's where I was trying to go a few minutes ago. Can you drive the homosexual relationship truck through it?
Well, to the extent that it never, ever explicitly says anything about homosexuality, you know, people do have to sort of interpolate or extrapolate a little bit to get that, and they do, but you can't get it quite exactly from the wording that's there. To say gender is eternal does not actually say you can't be homosexual, you know, even though that is, I'm fairly certain, what is meant. By gender is eternal. It doesn't actually say homosexuality does not exist. So, you know, there is room in there for sure, linguistically and discursively.
Well, I would add that the text is not concerned at all, although it talks about an eternal identity, is not at all concerned with a premortal or a postmortal realms. It's primarily interested in the sort of division of labor in the home between men and women, and another extent, the division of labor in society in general, that women should be at home, men should be out working. Ideally, it leaves open, as Christine said, a pretty wide berth for exceptions to that. And I think most people are pretty comfortable with those exceptions today. Women working, of men staying at home, those are relatively common occurrences in Latter-day Saint wards all across the world at this point. So the question is, the basis of that document for excluding homosexual relationships, especially in a post-mortal context, I mean, there's really nothing in that text that would say what it means to be male or female in the eternities. You know, it doesn't make a claim about spirit birth. It doesn't make it suggests that we're all literally sons and fathers, sons and daughters of our heavenly father, of our heavenly parents, it says, but not heavenly father and heavenly mother, you know. So I think there are lots of ways of that text being sort of reread to accommodate it. To accommodate same-sex relationships, and the room that's already left in for non-conforming heterosexual couples to exist perfectly in harmony with that document, thinking of non-heterosexual couples as living their lives in conformity with that text, in terms of there being someone who takes care of the kids and somebody who works. You know, I mean, there are lots of ways of thinking about how relationships might be constructed that could be consonant with that text.
Okay, cool.
I don't know. Maybe I'm overly optimistic.
No. You guys have me a little, I guess I'm a little more hopeful to work with the document than I was, you know, 10 minutes ago. But, you know, my initial thing was,
well,
minimize the document because there's some problems.
Well, again, all of this is so hypothetical. You know, Christine and I, and you, none of us are in charge of whenever, if ever, a change like this is ever made. And so what they decide to do with it will be up to them. you know, to jettison it, to interpret it more expansively, to keep it around. I mean, if a change is ever made, and whoever is making that decision, they've got options on the table. And I think our job is to sort of lay out those options. One might be to jettison it. One might be to keep it around. Who know who's? It's not my job to decide. So I just get to talk about options.
and it's an important role, especially. Yeah, it's fantastic to do what you're doing here. Okay, there's a few areas I want to take us into, and one of them relates. Well, first of all, the mismatch on the bodies not clearly being male or female seems to be one of those places. Well, first of all, okay, let's do this. It seems to me that Latter-day Saint discussion these days, and I've looked at it very positively, you know, if you really to look at the arc over the last 25 or 30 years, you know, since, you know, homosexuals have become a little bit more vocal and saying this is who we are and the attempt to explain and you know, we're getting better and better as a society in doing it. And I see Mormons right now becoming more compassionate, more empathetic. I don't know that until they really, really spend a lot of time with a son or a daughter or a close friend or somebody to, you probably have to listen over a couple year period, you know, to really get it fully intellectually. But I think we're doing better on compassion towards, right? Would you guys think that that's at least the case?
Yeah,
I'm asserting it, but you can challenge it.
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, the problem is, of course, that where the baseline is, you know, administering electric shocks to people while they watch gay porn. You know, better is not, you know, it's not necessarily good.
Right. No. Okay. Good. Yeah. No. But we're trending positively away from those things and towards. Okay, I'm a little bit more accepting of this as a fact of life, that maybe you didn't choose it, etc. But I still don't do it theologically, but I'm going to love you a bit more easily than I used to be able to.
Right, right. And I think Mike Otterson's statement after Elder Packer's conference talk, where he compared the trials of gay people in our culture to those of the Mormon pioneers, you know, that's pretty strong. That's about as empathic as I think Mormon discourse ever gets towards anyone. You know, so I think that is worth celebrating for sure.
Taylor, your general thought on, are we trending the right way, at least in this compassion, openness to individuals area?
I would second Christine's endorsement of Michael Otterson's statement. It's by far the best thing that has been said by any Latter-day Saint leader or public relations official that I'm aware of, and it's a really quite moving piece. I would add that there are some other really interesting developments. I think that the fact that the BYU Honor Code changed in 2007 to allow students to openly claim an identity, a homosexual identity, and that generally is being reflected, I think, in many Latter-day Saint communities, especially in urban areas where there are Latter-day Saints who are known by their communities, by their leaders, as identifying as gay, that's actually a really interesting development that's happened. Of course, there aren't gay relationships that exist in those contexts, at least not that I'm aware of, very, very few. I think there are a few that I've heard about, but the idea that people can sort of identify as homosexual publicly is a really interesting development for Latter-day Saints, and I think one that definitely points in the right direction. By no means have we crossed over a line where there's no risk of going back to the bad old days, but there are definitely some good signs that I think that a lot of people should be happy about and be paying attention to. So.
Okay, good, good. Now here's where I wanted to set that up. You guys did the proper amount of reining in my enthusiasm, so thank you. all right, I'm thinking of William James, and he always talks well about, you know, we have these opinions already, we meet a new experience that puts them to a strain. Somebody contradicts our ideas, or in a reflective moment we discover that our ideas are contradictory to each other. We hear facts which are incompatible, desires arise which can no longer be satisfied, etc. The result is an inward trouble in which our minds up till then have been a stranger, and we seek to escape this by modifying our previous opinions, right? So last we come up on a new idea that we can graft into our old stuff, but the whole point with William James is we want to use the minimal amount of of change. In other words, we like the stuff we've been thinking all along, and it's only when we're forced to do it. And so I was obviously paraphrasing him. Well, it seems to me that the intersex stuff, Taylor, is probably the one that you can simply say this eternal gender and that spirits match bodies. That seems to be one of those facts that you're going to have to accommodate somehow. So it seems to me like a really interesting an entry point here. And also, I guess the other thing I wanted to say is whatever you guys have said in the past is true. You know, when you were kind of commenting on the direction we're going and things like that, that's all great. But none of the stuff that you kind of were talking about was theological, take aim directly at theology. And I think intersex can kind of do that better than anything else. So I don't know. Am I wrong again? I love when you guys qualify me. But does that one, is it been around too long and it's been a non-starter, or is it simply a matter of education that someone's got to come along and simply say, what is it? You know, I've heard like 1 out of 1,000 or even more births like that that has the ambiguous genitalia of some sort.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed to confess that I didn't realize until really recently how common it is. I think the statistic I saw most recently that brought me up short is that it's actually slightly more common than Down syndrome, you know, which is amazing because,
wow,
you know, we all know, you know, several people with Down syndrome for sure, you know, but I don't know that I know anyone who is intersexed, but I must, you know, statistically that mm-hmm. is probably the case.
Well, and often people don't know themselves. Interestingly,
right.
You know, there are a lot of famous cases of athletes that genetic testing has revealed that they're genetically male or, you know, and they're competing in female sports, but their entire bodies of appear and function as female. And so there are really interesting ways in which people don't necessarily even know themselves.
Right. Where genotype, you know, not only does eternal, you know, gender, whatever that is, not coincide with physical gender, but genotype doesn't even correspond with phenotype.
I think that, you know, the idea of not the idea, but the reality of intersexuality does really challenge our notions of eternal gender, not necessarily on the issue of sexual identities as we've been thinking about them, but as analogously as the problems that this concept of gender has for sort of excluding certain kinds of people from sealing, from membership in the church, from you know, so many of the blessings, and not only intersexuals or intersexuality, but also transsexuality. And there's actually been some really interesting changes in the church's policy on transsexuality in the last few decades as well. Cases that I know of, at least secondhand, of male to female transsexuals who were ordained to the priesthood as young men, and how does that, what does that mean for them? And the church has had to come up with policies along those lines. And so anyway, there's some really interesting things that the ways that people's real experiences, again, are sort of challenged, and we bump up against them as not fitting into the preconceptions. I think the William James quote that you give is really interesting, useful there, that we're sort of faced by reality sometimes, you know.
Oh God, this is just fascinating to me. What I guess, if I were to say somebody would look at your article, Taylor, and go, "Oh man, this guy is just opening up the world, and there's so much here to deal with," and that's a wonderful thing about your article here. But if somebody were to approach this with just a piece of, you know, one issue at a time, you know, like the William James stuff really kind of says one piece of information will accommodate and graft into our old ideas with the minimal amount of disturbance, but then there's another, and I think that's probably better. You guys may agree or may not agree then, you know, so use Taylor's article as a wide, you know, here's the book and here's a whole bunch of different things you can do, but probably the best idea is just to really pick one or two entry points if you're going to rethink it for yourself, or even possibly to try to shape the discussion here before, I don't know how many more decades there will be before we really would probably see a lot of changes here, but how do you seed the question? You know, Taylor, you've given us a lot to do that, but do you kind of agree that maybe just one or two? And at least for me, it occurs to me that the intersex piece is one to start with.
I don't know. I wrote the whole thing, so I feel like it's all really important. So I'm probably the wrong person to ask, but I think that one of the things that I hope people can see from this, no matter where one is at on this, is I felt like I sort of had a really fatalistic view that Latter-day Saint theology was sort of, you know, locked into a kind of heterosexual universe and that there was no real way of thinking outside of that. And I hope that people can see that there are ways of thinking outside of that. Now, we may choose as a community to continue to remain bound to kind of this heterosexual ideal for various reasons. And, you know, that may be the direction that we go. But I think that it's important that we recognize that that's a choice, that we're not locked into that by any sort of, you know, predetermined set. Now, how God wants things to be is another issue that may bound us to various things. But, you know, that there are options within our theology that we can think with. So I think that just thinking that it's even possible at all for me was a really useful exercise, and I hope that other people can benefit from that.
Good, I love that.
Yeah, and maybe sort of the other side of that coin is that one of the things I really like about this is the possibility it provides to think about these questions in distinctively Mormon ways. It seems to me like most of the time when Latter-day Saints discuss these issues tend to simply borrow the discourse of American, you know, liberal conservative politics. Or sometimes in our more sophisticated discussions, we sound a lot like Catholics. You know, our theology, we talk about celibacy and fallenness, and you know, we borrow terms that don't fit easily into Mormon theology. And so I guess what I hope is that this is the beginning of an escape from simply, you know, sort of endlessly reproducing American debates about how to handle these questions practically and politically, and the beginning of a way to think through them theologically. Because my suspicion is that if we could solve the theological problem, the political and practical and pastoral problems would start to seem a lot easier. But they're going at them, you know, going at it starting from the political problem, or, you know, or even the pastoral issue of how to love our gay brothers and sisters. You know, we run into dead ends pretty quickly because, you know, how do you say to someone, you know, I love you, but I want you to be lonely and I want you to not be able to fully participate in the blessings of the gospel, but I really love you. I mean, it's just, it's not
terrific.
Convincing until we solve the theological problem. And so, I love the idea of moving the discourse to that level to see if we can make progress there.
Absolutely. This is a great piece for that. There's one other minor entry point. Taylor, there's this one sentence. Church teachings assert two ideas about gender identity that are in significant tension. And I just love this. You say it asserts that gender is eternal, immutable aspect of one's existence. But then you point out that it looks like they must think that notions of gender identity and roles are so contingent that they have to be constantly enforced and taught, especially to young children. So in other words, it's like they're making this strong claim about eternal gender that should just simply make sense as the natural way the world is, but then they're having to spend all this time reinforcing particular notions about it and teaching it. Is that a starting point for, is that something you could bring up in Sunday school? or something, you know, why are we doing all this? If you know, would people simply come back with you and say, well, that just shows how hard Satan's working, you know, so we're just having to fight the battle at Satan who's trying to confuse these things. But in some ways, it was a really interesting point for me. I had to smile when I read that part of your article, Taylor.
Well, I'm glad that you enjoyed it and found that part useful. It was one of those real kind of head scratcher moments as I was reading through some of these Latter-day Saint documents on this, especially the Divine Institution of Marriage, which seems to make these two claims, you know, sometimes within sentences of each other. And it's a tension that's not just in that text, it's really broadly found in a number of other Latter-day Saint texts and sort of para Latter-day Saint materials on homosexual, you know, conversion therapies and stuff like that that some Latter-day Saint scholars have worked on, is this idea that, you know, this is the natural way, this is what males and females are supposed to be like, they're supposed to be heterosexual in these particular ways. And in order to make sure that nature runs its course, you have to be sure that, you know, your child acts in this way and acts in that way and acts in that way. You know, and there's this real attempt to sort of form heterosexuals, while at the same time saying that it's nature. And that tension, I think, exposes a real problem. Well, it's a real tension, obviously. So,
right.
I think that if we can get past some of the nature language and pay attention to the ways in which we are enforcing and encouraging and regulating heterosexuality, is one of the ways I think that we can maybe rethink some of the practices that have excluded non-conforming peoples.
Very cool. Christine, anything on that particular head scratcher?
No, except that, you know, for me, it was, I recognized it not in the discourse on heterosexuality, but on femininity and motherhood. You know, we tell our young women,
yes.
You know, you were created to be a mother and to enjoy that more than anything, and therefore we are going to, you know, teach you, you know, every third Sunday about how important it is to be a mother because otherwise you might not realize how deeply embedded this is in your divine nature. You know,
awesome.
We do exactly the same thing there.
Yeah.
Terrific. Hey, well, this has been it wasn't intended just to get everybody to rush out and read his article, though I highly recommend it. But I think we've at least kind of covered a lot of stuff. But everybody who's out there, this is important to read. Read the quotes, read the footnotes. If you're interested in being part of the discussion, and at least, you know, if you're hanging in there, especially on Sundays, or you just find those opportunities in side conversations with friends or family, this is a great article to have some vocabulary and some actual things to do with. But I just, if you guys don't mind, if we close, I'd love to just, Taylor, you talked a little bit about you're more optimistic now, or it sort of changed you from pessimism to at least more optimism. I know neither of you are I guess what is the reason for hope that either of you have, or is there some LDS expansive idea that just makes you think that there's at least a solid possibility that don't say how many years from now, but that we can kind of build some more momentum, and are there theories that are in the gospel, or their sensibilities about the eternal nature of spirits, or something like that, that gives you hope for LDS discourse?
I think that change and growth happens at the moment when people recognize that tradition is inadequate, that the explanations they've had in the past don't quite explain the messy reality that they encounter.
Good.
And the reason I think that change often happens so slowly and so painfully is that we rely on tradition to guard against chaos and, you know, this sort of terrifying possibility of freedom. And, you know, the good news about Mormonism is that we have this idea of revelatory change as a point that both, you know, that allows us to jettison traditions that are no longer working to explain our experience and redeem it to us, as we are living it. And it also promises us that freedom need not be terrifying. And so to the extent that we can, you know, lay hold on the possibility of revelatory change in Mormonism, I think it's possible. And I think when it does happen, it happens remarkably quickly in Mormonism, that when there is an insight, when that revelation happens, in part because of our devotion to our traditions and to the authority that enforces them, we are also capable of moving ahead into, you know, joyous new freedoms in a way that is really beautiful in it. And I think that possibility is always there in Mormonism, even when it seems about to be, you know, smothered and stupefied by the foolish traditions of our fathers and our mothers. But it's there, and I really deeply believe that potential is alive within Mormonism.
Cool. Thank you. Taylor, any angle that you would take on that?
I think Christine said it about as well as anybody could. I don't know what the future holds. I know that from history, we can't always expect that things are going to go in the directions that we hope. And, the 20th century has been a pretty instructive century in terms of world events that teach us that things don't always progress uniformly. So I don't know. I don't know what the future holds, but I think that I remain hopeful that our brothers and sisters will find a place in this church, and that their lives and their experiences and their contributions and the blessings that the gospel offers can be theirs as well. So that's my hope and that's my prayer, and we'll leave it up to those who get to make those decisions about what will happen.
Yeah, cool. Thanks.
I don't know. Maybe you can cut that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I love it. I do think I really liked what you said, Christine, in an earlier section about, you know, if you're leading with the pastoral, if you're leading with the political, it's not going to happen as much as we have the theology. And so when you guys were talking about revelation and the chance that it can move in those ways, you know, I'm all for that. But at that moment, at least you were leaving the theological piece a little bit out of it. And so for me, any hope that I have, mostly, you know, I already gave a couple of non-starters. You told me about, well, let's trash the, you know, let's de-emphasize that. But it is in the level of the metaphysics. It is in that level of, Taylor, what you talked about earlier in it, of the eternal nature of intelligence and whatever this core sensibility of identity and stuff like that was non-gendered at one time, you know?
To some extent, I'm not sure that we need revelation with a capital R even, you know, possibly, right? Possibly we might, but there are past practices, past reading. I mean, lots of things get changed in our church all the time without revelation with a capital R. And so that's it. I think that we need to not necessarily demand or require that we have revelation on this issue as the primary way that it needs to be addressed.
Right.
We may need revelation, but there are ways that we can change policies and change practices without appeals to revelation as well, with a capital R as well. So
yeah,
certainly
we seek
inspiration.
I was going to say we may only need the revelation of the face of God in our brothers and sisters, that may be
cool.
What we really need most of all.
Yeah, and I got the sense, Christine, when you talked about it can happen kind of fast or something, that did sort of sound a little bit more like me, like, hey, you know, once they say something like, for instance, 1978, you know, you kind of make a sharper turn than just the gradual stuff that this small R kind of revelation might be. But I guess just let me riff for another couple of minutes here a little bit on, you know, I do think it's Mormonism has forgotten that it has these really interesting, Taylor, I don't know if you had the same experience I did. I'd bring up in, you know, we'd be discussing about the mind body problem, or we'd be talking about the problem of evil in all my theology classes. And I'll say, you know, Mormonism's take on this is this, and their jaws would drop and they're saying, Mormonism has a take? I mean, there's something other than these radical Republican conservatives. They actually, there's thought. You know, so we have these unique angles that I think we've forgotten about in our Sunday discourses. So I love the stuff that talks about the ungendered nature of an intelligence and the fact that now you've helped us a little bit think about, you know, gendered spirits or children of God not necessarily coming through sexual reproduction, or, you know, you guys are talking about even the proclamation of family being not so clear that this means male or female, and it's not talking about post-life, you know, type of things. And so all those things to me are really, really helpful. So for instance, one of the things, Taylor, you said, maybe Dan, you'll write an article or something to play with. One of the things I got alerted to in my graduate years was I just for what I won't go the whole story, but I read a book called 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation, and it was by Ian Stevenson. And that led me for the last 20 years to be sort of fascinated by reincarnation literature. You know, so I've got all the life after life, you know, books and or life before life books and the different things like that. And I've, you know, played with the Tibetan Book of the Dead and, you know, different things like that, where there is this idea of pretty consistently that often spirits will incarnate as male or female by choice to learn certain things, but that their eternal spirit isn't gendered. And again, Mormonism has this long history of at least some sort of sense of the potter's wheel and native intelligence and starting over, and that embodiment is, you know, you can learn more through embodiment than you can being unembodied, you know, so it's important to get a body, it's important to have a veil of forgetfulness, and so therefore the gist, at least to me, of the plan of salvation is if you're going to learn all of the experiences that God has learned, you know, there might be more fluidity towards, you know, whatever this child of godness is than simply it's a male or a female spirit. And you know, and I know that a lot of gays and lesbians, if you start talking to them about, there's this idea that perhaps this is an experience for this life only, they don't like that, because, you know, they want to say, no, I really want the eternities that's going to accommodate me and my relationship, so I want to honor that. But at least there is some sort of long history within Mormonism of thinking in terms of, well, what's the point of eternal lives? It's to have experience, it's to grow in compassion, it's to do this. And if one life doesn't get you all the way there, why not have another, you know, mortal probation? So anyway, is that too wacky for you guys, or I can back off it in terms of just like, I love exploring the idea of intelligence to spirit to body to post-mortal. That's great enough. But at least it seems to me that there is a gist within the plan of salvation that could suggest the other.
You're on your own on that one, Dan.
because of the critique that comes from homosexuals who would say, no, this same-sex relationship, I want it honored in there, or you just simply say it's just too far out in Mormon theology?
Yeah, I think multiple mortal probations is a stretch. Not an impossible one. And it's not particular, you know, I don't find it especially compelling, but you can do it. You can write it.
You'll publish it in Dialogue? No.
It depends. It would depend on what the referees say, Dan.
Yeah, no, that's cool. But, I mean, Taylor, is it just way too far out for you? Have you read any of that material at all?
I just a little bit, and I think that it's really interesting. I think that the relationship between our pre-mortal life and our mortal lives is one of the least thought about in terms of Mormon theology, and there's potentially some really interesting things to say about it. I think we've got some really common notions around that attempt to explain the problem of evil, the problem of suffering, and so on. But I think there's maybe a lot more to be said about it. I think that one interesting way of thinking about this too, and one of the things I think that your idea points to, is the fluidity of our sexual lives too. And I think that part of our problem sometimes is this binary thinking that one is either homosexual or heterosexual. And that,
good point.
And I think that your notion there is one where we can think about that in theologically expansive ways as well, that doesn't lock us into those kinds of fixed identities. Those are, I think, incredibly important politically, maybe even theologically, but also people's experience doesn't necessarily always match up to that binary as well. So that's another area, I think, of further investigation.
Yeah, and it's any of this stuff isn't anything I would bring up in church, you know, kind of settings. But I do think when you play at that metaphysical level of, you know, the eternal stuffness that is all of us, you know, that's this intelligence core. I don't know. It feels fair game with me, but I certainly would never call it Mormon doctrine. But you know what I mean. But you know, there's lots of ways to dismiss some of the statements in Scripture that simply say this life is the life to prepare to meet God, and that all eternity, you know, hinges on this life moment and things like that. There's ways to work out around those, not necessarily, you know, I mean, obviously they have very important focusing effects on us to kind of say, hey, pay attention, you're in this life here. But on the other hand, when you think about the gist of, you know, if this is a universe that creates souls that you would be willing to call God, or that has the godlike compassions and things like that, I don't think that, again, I don't necessarily claim it as my belief, but I don't have a problem a lot thinking of reincarnation as a possibility. So anyway, that's where I might jump in.
The point that Christine brought up too about the goal, and it's something that, you know, that in many ways really motivated this project on my part too, is that thinking of something really authentically Mormon, and that is within the Mormon tradition in such a way that people can resonate with, identify it as Mormon, and whether or not that, you know, I think you're well aware of this too, but whether or not people resonate with that idea as a solution that Mormons would accept is sort of to be tested. And the same thing can be said about my arguments as well. And that's why I think we all need to keep kind of experimenting and thinking and working on this issue. And I hope that other people would be inspired to think about this issue and think about aspects of our past that, you know, might open up some other new possibilities for addressing these issues and other kinds of questions that we might face as well.
Great place to end. Thanks. Please, everybody, jump in. Christine, any final thing from you?
No, I've said way more than anyone could possibly hear from me.
not even close. But anyway, you guys are terrific. Taylor, thank you for this article. I've just have loved it. I've lived with it now in my brain for the last 4 or 5 months, and I've just been grateful to have it there and constantly churning, and I hope that a lot of our listeners will find it. Christine, is this available without ordering the whole issue? I'm not sure what Dialogue's policy
is. It is. I'll send you a link. It's up as free content. And we could link to the discussion of it at BCC as well. And there are a couple of really thoughtful responses to it on the Dialogue website as well. So.
Oh, great. Please do that. And then let's have our own thoughtful responses and conversation at the Mormon Matters blog. So if everybody will at the end of this podcast, jump in with your own thoughts and who's crazy and who's not. And yeah, I'm sure I'll get the crazy talk ones. But no, I just look forward to it. But I'm just grateful for the discussion. It's so important to have. And I really think that what you had said a couple times there, Christine, of the theology has to be a big piece of this. We're not going to get there purely through pastoral or political stuff. We need to do this. So Taylor, thank you for writing this.
Dan, thank you so much for inviting me on, for bringing my article to a broader audience. I really have been very thankful for the positive responses that I've gotten from it, and that people are finding it interesting and useful and something worth thinking about. So I'm very thankful for that. And thank you, Christine, for publishing it and for participating in the conversation tonight.
Oh, I'm really, it's one of the things I'm most proud of in my time at Dialogue. I'm really glad that I got to publish it.
Awesome. And thank you, Christine, for sending the links and stuff you do. But that does not mean that people should not still subscribe to Dialogue, right? So please encourage people to do that, right? Those of you who've maybe come into these discussions and podcasts as your main way, there is still something to be said to have that in print and have it in front of you and to be able to see the footnotes. And the same thing when you're just concentrating on blogs and whatnot, you're going to get some good stuff there. There's something about the long form and the really thoughtful, well-edited, well-crafted writing that we just can't forget about. So this has been a great example.
And you can read it in the bathtub, which you can't do
awesome. That's right. Very dangerous to do that. It could be very awesome. Anyway, well, thanks, listeners, for all that you do to support Mormon Matters. We hope that you'll keep doing it, especially with the financial part. But hey, we are well over 10,000 downloads per episode. We're moving up with some of them into the 20 and 25,000 downloads. So Mormon Matters is a going concern, and we appreciate everything that everyone does to promote it and to support it. And we hope that this will not discourage you from continuing the good trajectory that we're on. But Christine and Taylor, thanks so much for the good conversation tonight. Really loved having you guys on.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.